Hello, and welcome to episode 351 of the Crate and Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast, being recorded on the 2nd of December, 2020. I'm Marsh Davis, and I'm joined this evening by Tarnex Dreadspear.
Hello.
And Morgo the Globulark.
Hello.
Hello, chaps.
Hi.
Nice to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Did you hear the news this week?
The
news that I was thinking of was that over 15 million Fortnite players crammed themselves into Galactus's mouth.
Thank God.
And 3 more million of them watched it live, which is quite a lot of people to fit into a mouth.
For how long must Gen Z pay the price for our generation's sort of bottomless perfidy? You know, first all the mounting challenges in the world that they must eventually face, and now this.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking if you think about it.
Well, I only mention this because last week the pod speculated that maybe the Avengers video game underperformance was in some way related to the fact that Fortnite had somewhat eaten its biscuits, as Tom Senior would say. Mm. And maybe that's true. I don't know. The numbers are staggering.
But are they? Are they? Because I was thinking about, like, you know, that is an enormous number of people. And it's enormous. It must have been a large proportion of all the people playing games, you know, of that kind of, you know, demanding, complex sort of, you know, device requiring kind of games. But then again, you know, if you think back to even just British TV, back when there were only sort of 3 or 4 channels, like one of the kind of an evening show would routinely have that number of people watching. Obviously, you know, the appeal of something like Coronation Street or some big short soap opera like that is probably wider than something like Fortnite. But, you know, when you extend that across the entire world and the fact that Fortnite is on every device, I was thinking, really though, that's a major event for Fortnite. It's important to the game. Should it be more? I don't know. Like, I don't know. When 15 million is a number of people that I cannot remotely conceive of. But at the same time, next to other forms of popular media, is it all that?
Right, probably like the Coronation Street Christmas special in 1990 probably got 15 million people easily, right?
For sure. I think that they fairly routinely, back in the day, I think they routinely got this, not even specials.
You got that many people in the Hacienda, wasn't there? It's like, I think, I mean,
they got that many people listening to Gracie Fields.
I do see what you're saying, but I think the accessibility bar is so different that it is. And also the offering is so much more complicated as a thing, right? It's not tune in for the last episode of the story, really, that makes sense in the linear fashion. It's like attend a branded marketing event in a complicated way at a complicated time. Like it is.
Yeah, they wouldn't
number.
See it as being a marketing event. That they would say that it's the game. But then also they could what they you know there was it 3 million people watching on on Twitch.
Yeah. Mm. Who's the they in your assessment there? The people playing it or Mr. Epic?
Oh, they? Well, the players, the Fortnite heads.
Right.
I think that they see it as the game. It's like the thing they want. It's the story. I think it's really cool. I think I love this stuff. I really like the way that a live story is being played in real time to an audience or with an audience. I think it's cool as heck.
It is cool. I do think, though, that I agree with you that I don't think that the audience necessarily sees it as marketing. But what I'm saying is, like, as a story, it is a far more complex thing than, like, yeah, the Coronation Street Christmas special as a proposition, right? Like, in terms of, you know, who it appeals to, in terms of how and what it's saying and how easy that is to summarize or bring a new person into, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's an unusual thing to be popular on this scale, I think.
Yeah.
And I think its success is directly a kind of reflective of the cultural position of the game itself, rather than something that would generate this kind of interest on its own merits. basically. In fact, I think that's the striking thing, that it is Fortnite driving those numbers, not the Marvel license, for example.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Also, I think the nature of the media is so different now than when Coronation Street was hitting those sort of numbers. Like, I mean, it's a higher bar to get 15 million children to sit down at the same time now than it was for something that could only be consumed on a single date back then. And like, I mean, it's almost unthinkable to kids born after the millennium now that anybody would have to wait for any sort of entertainment. You know, the idea of scheduling is madness. I experience this myself. Like when I go home to visit my parents, and they're looking at what's on television tonight. And I'm just like, well, all of television is on tonight. You know?
Right. And I think that's the other thing is, you know, a 90s British TV special is what meaningfully competing with maybe two or three other things. Like, and I don't just mean, like, apart from, like, technically the totality of all books or whatever, but in terms of, like, equivalent media.
It's Bob Monkhouse on two or.
Yeah, this, right? And so it's just a different world to competing with literally all visual, all media ever, basically, in that moment.
Yeah,
like,
true.
In terms of competition for people's time. You know, every other game, every other television show you could possibly be watching, every other thing they could be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, it's a lot, is what we're saying.
Yeah, I do concede that over 15 million people putting battle buses into Galactus's mouth is a lot.
Is it enough for him, though? That's really the question that we should be asking. Is he sated?
How big is a Galactus?
Oh, quite big.
His name suggests he is quite large.
Then we failed.
More children. Shovel more.
You also had some news, didn't you, Chris?
Yeah, I thought I'd mention this is the opposite end of every spectrum that could describe. Fail Better of Fallen London and the Sunless Games announced their new game today. Which is called Mask of the Rose and is, well, Mask of the Rose, subtitled A Fallen London Romance. It is a romantic visual novel set as a prequel to Fallen London, but in a kind of sort of, a kind of zoomed in, kind of narrower, more personal depiction of that setting in the visual novel format, which I personally think is quite a nice fit. Like I have wanted them to explore that setting in a little bit more of a kind of zoomed in, personal, discreet way, I guess, than they typically do, where they tend to have zoomed out quite a bit, all the way to space. And I'm also interested for a story that's more specifically character driven. The trailer seems to suggest that it is, and it has a set, like, you know, it sounds like it has a kind of mixture of like mystery solving, Fallen London, you know, sort of weirdness and like some dating element, I guess, with a narrow cast of characters. And I'm kind of interested to see what they do with a narrow, more specific cast, given how their house style is built around very kind of vividly drawn characters, but who are kind of held at somewhat of a distance off by frequently like the absence of names, the absence of too much specificity of a certain kind. Everything's kind of gestural and told through these vignettes. And I think it'd be interesting to see what they do with something a little bit more specific, basically. Seems nice.
Do you know if they're using any of the Fallen London-y kind of narrative mechanics where, like, you know, notional tokens kind of unlock options and things? I mean, visual novels are by their nature much more linear and straighter, but
it depends. I think there's already like a pretty strong visual novel heritage or an IF heritage in what they already do, and I think all of those games tend to exist on a spectrum between like being purely like, you know, branching kind of choose your own adventure type things and having more narrative systems or sort of resource systems underpinning that. So I don't know. And I think they've said where that falls. I would be interested to see them do something that's less built on that like resource gathering and spending framework, like their particular engine and the way that you kind of gather and, you know, gather and expend your kind of points in various buckets in order to kind of achieve story outcomes. Not that doesn't work, it's just it'd be interesting to see them do something a little bit different. But yeah, Seems nice.
When is it out?
Check my email right now is what I could do. I'm doing it right now. Oh boy, it's happening. They're going to be kickstarting it in February 2021.
Cool.
So sounds pretty early if that's the case.
Good for them. What have you been playing, Chris?
Oh boy. All right. I think I spoiled this for you already, Marsh. But I think I've achieved a final kind of lockdown DEFCON this week level in terms of my who I am and what I do. And I think I would describe a lot of this as the progress into like morphing animorph style into myself, but aged 17. I've achieved this in terms of my hair, which is very long now. I had achieved it a while ago in terms of my hobbies, interests, general level of cultural kind of achievement. But to put no finer point on it, I resubscribed to World of Warcraft.
Oh my lord, really?
Yeah. And I've had some experiences this week, and I'd like to tell you about them if that's all right. Because I did this out of a few things. One, curiosity. It got a new expansion, Shadowlands, which just came out. I will caveat this by saying, if you want Shadowlands hot takes, I'm not your man, because you need a level 50 character to play that, and I don't have one. So I will get to it, but there's a new expansion, and that did draw me in a little bit, because the new expansion is a very different setting to all of the others, and I was interested to see what that was like, and it had some good things, and it's a little tickle of nostalgia. And also, I think, you know, the present, even given my vast fortunateness, the present has turned me into a kind of like comfort-seeking pillow man that just wants to be coddled, and Warcraft kind of has that air to me of a comfortable game from a long time ago. But also professionally, I was curious about a few things. One of them was that I'd heard they had substantially revamped the new player experience, and I'm very curious about how games achieve this at the moment for various reasons, and in how to. And I'd heard they'd done a really good job of it, so I wanted to see that. And also I had this sort of curiosity, given that I, you know, play a lot of Destiny, a game I love very much, but that has gone through this process of excising all of its content. I wanted to see what it feels like to go to a game that is 16 years old at this point, where very little content has been excised. Like, obviously the world got a revamp when the Cataclysm expansion came out, but in terms of, like, it's not really lost territory. It's carrying all of this all this, not baggage necessarily, but just stuff, like all these different ideas. And I wanted to see how that cohered or didn't. So I went in and I went back to it, and I've had some experiences. I really have. I logged back into my old main, which is a character I made the day World of Warcraft launched in Europe when I was 17, after having played different characters and you know, decided on a particular one during the beta test, the closed beta and then the open beta. So it felt like it's a strange thing to go back to that character and to find them exactly where they were in Nagrand, in Draenor, midway through a bunch of quests that I had picked up according to the achievement list in 2009. I haven't really touched it since. So to literally just move back to, like, I had just graduated from uni and it was the summer after uni, and I was like, I am now a comfort seeking pillow man, and what will I do? I will do this. But then I was like, I want to see the new player experience, and I feel a bit overwhelmed and lost in the old character. So I made a new character and I did the new player experience. And it's really slick. I think they've done a really good job of it. And I think it's a good lesson in how to build a tutorial for something that complicated and storied, and also maybe just how to tutorialize MMOs generally. It does some really cool stuff that I took through recently. Basically, it takes about an hour and a quarter to rocket you from level 1 to level 10. And it's a self-contained experience set on a little island. You get shipwrecked on an island, and some ogres are trying to resurrect a bad dragon, and you've got to stop them. And it feels like a kind of one-shot little D&D arc. It's not weighed down very much by WoW's broader lore. We'll get to that. It's just a little fantasy adventure in a colorful world. And crucially, they use this, I think they introduced this probably like a decade ago, but I hadn't seen it used this sophisticatedly. They use this phasing technology. So you are in a world with lots of other players, but exactly what you're each seeing is very finely tuned to each of you, minute by minute and moment by moment. So you are having your own experience, and so are all the other players, and there's nothing in what they're doing or what you're doing that seems to break each other's flow, but you're definitely not seeing the same things. And that's kind of interesting how they've achieved that. And that allows you to be accompanied, for example, by named characters who are talking to you and guiding you through stuff without every player doing that. Like, you'll occasionally see other players accompanied by, like, nameless kind of horde mooks. And but for those players, those are the main characters, for example. It's quite cleverly done. And they do lots of really nice things like encouraging you to spar an NPC at one point. And the NPC, it listens to what inputs you're putting in specific to your class and kind of teaches you live to play your class, which is not something I've seen games do particularly well. So for example, playing as a warlock, I would do a thing where if I reapplied my damage over time ability to my foe when I didn't need to, because it doesn't stack, it would say that. It would say, hey, you don't have to reapply that spell to me just yet. Reapply it when it's about to expire. And it would just do all these context sensitive things for everything you could do. And sort of lots of just very elegant tutorial design like that. And I enjoyed it. And I was like, yeah, this is maybe I do play WoW again. Like, this is very comfortable and very feels like kind of home in a way. And all it's very polished and very slick. And then after that, you're taken to the capital city. So for me, it was Orgrimmar, and you're given a tour of the city and explained how everything works and given your mount. And it's so much quicker and easier than it ever was before. And I had a moment where I realized I do play WoW again, I made a warlock, and warlocks summon demons, and those demons are given a randomly generated name the first time they're summoned, and that's just their name from then on. So you have like an imp and a void walker and other things. And I summoned my first imp, and its name was Pip Rot. Oh. And I was like, that's a sign. I guess I play this now. But anyway, so this is building to a butt. And oh boy, what a butt. So I'm playing along, and its idea is it loads you in to the capital city, gives you a tour. And at that point, the task is level up to level 50, at which point the new expansion begins. And so they have done something I think is super cool here, which is they obviously have a ton of content over 8 expansions in years and years and years and years, a massive world, storylines on top of storylines on top of storylines. It is totally unreasonable to expect a player to play from the beginning of WoW to the end, even though they could. And you'd hit the level cap long before you did that, so you'd be doing it for its own sake. So what they've done is introduced a feature. It's called Chromey Time in-game, but it's basically super phasing, essentially, where you can go to an NPC who's a little time dragon that looks like a gnome, and you can tell them what campaign you want to play. What story do you want to see? As the specific leveling experience for this character. And you can choose from the Cataclysm expansion, Warlords of Draenor, which is the first expansion, Wrath of the Lich King, all of the expansions, basically. And then what it does is it rephases the entire game world to be as it was narratively, if not in terms of the full feature set, when that expansion came out.
Blimey.
And you can only see players who are in the same timeline as you. And it changes what dungeons you can queue for. And it also gives, it puts like adaptive level scaling for all of those zones that you've chosen. So what that means is, you know, if I pick the Wrath of the Lich King one, I could just go to that new continent they added for that expansion, play through that content all the way to the end, and that will get me to the level cap, at which point I can return to the present to play the new stuff. And I think that's super smart, because it means that, you know, one, it encourages you to make alts and play through different things, and it finds, I think, a role for those expansions, which when they were released were there to add on stuff to the end of the game, basically. To sustain engagement for the players who are already playing. And so having that kind of, that block of effort, that block of creativity and development effort, which represents a slice of Blizzard at a particular point in time, to have that broken out and become like a self-contained campaign in its own right. Like, most of these take like 16 to 24 hours to finish, and that's your entire leveling up. That's super good. That's like, people should nick this idea clever, I think. And obviously a big technical investment to get it to work, but like, very appealing, I think, as a way of taking that massive history and breaking it down into consumable chunks. But obviously the other thing that introduces is a lot of choice paralysis. Like, talk about big town problems, and then you talk about like big time problems, big basically. Multiverse. Like, yeah. Big multiverse problem. And so I thought, well, I'm just gonna, with this character, this new character, this first like toe back in the shallow waters, I am going to just do what it points me towards.
Is there a general sort of like fan consensus over what the sort of the heyday expansion timeline, whatever you want to call it, was? Like, do people say, "Oh, well, Wrath of the Lich King, that was always been the best one, so go back to that"?
I think that is considered, I think that it's interesting. I was reading a little bit about the reaction to this, and a lot of it was to do with like which ones are fastest for leveling and stuff like that. As far as I can tell, WoW expansions are a bit like Star Trek movies in that every other one is great. So apparently the current one's really good. The previous one was rubbish. The one before that was good. That's probably too broad a brush, and there might be WoW players that disagree, but you know, whatever. But people definitely have favorites, but there's also different flavors. Like Cataclysm was such a kind of world spanning thing that going back to Cataclysm doesn't really put you in a particular place to play a particular story. It puts you back in a certain status quo of the world as a whole. And that's a kind of interesting distinction. But it's cool. Also, crucially, you don't have to do this. You can play through those stories in the present. It's just that they don't level scale in quite the same way, and certain details will be out of sync with the timeline of the story, such as it is. But as I say, I decided that I would follow what it wanted me to do. And I think on paper, what it wants you to do makes a ton of sense. What it does is it basically says they have applied that same level scaling in the present, quote unquote, to the entire like leveling content of the previous expansion, which was called Battle for Azeroth, the new ones. Shadowlands, Battle for Azeroth came out in 2018, I think. And so what that means is the intended, now that WoW is free, for example, up to level 20 at least, the intended arc of the experience for a new player is you jump in, you play the tutorial, you do this brief introduction to the capital city, and then you join the story proper at the beginning of the previous expansion. That takes you all the way up to finishing, that takes you all the way up to level 50, at which point you're in a position to buy and jump onto the new expansion. That makes sense on paper. Like, onboard people onto the most recent part of the story, get them up to speed, introduce them, sell them the new thing, and on we go. And so I kind of followed that path. I didn't really know anything about Battle for Azeroth at all until I played it. And I don't know how to dance around this. I was like, I went from being like, maybe I play WoW again, to canceling my subscription in order to have a form to complain in, like a feedback form to fill out within an hour of the start of that.
What did it do to you, Chris?
And so this is where I'm going to take a bit of a left turn, and there's a few other things I would like to say about WoW, but this is the meat of it. I was taken aback, and this is also an area where I want to caveat with, like, this is my experience of this, and I think this is a subject that's going to have really broad viewpoints. I was shocked by how insensitive it was.
To whom?
People of color.
Oh.
I appreciate this might be relevant to other games that have been played this week. Like, I don't think that the council of white English dudes who live in Bath is necessarily the people that you would consult on matters of like colonial representation in games.
Right.
Necessarily. And I want to caveat that. And it's obviously not my lived experience, and I caveat with that as well. But basically, the Horde part of this expansion that they onboard you onto, and bear in mind, this is the first narrative experience you have after the tutorial, and I'm almost putting myself in the mind of a brand new player as well, is about recruiting the trolls of Zandalar to the Horde. And what this is a story where, well, in game, in real life, it's a story where I think someone watched Black Panther and didn't understand why it worked and didn't see the reasons why it succeeded and the sensitivities that are required to make it succeed, where other attempts to address the same subject matter might have failed quite badly. And so basically you're sent to this sort of reclusive island nation of trolls, and Warcraft trolls, basically in the 90s, someone thought it'll be funny if the trolls have variously like Jamaican Caribbean accents.
And it was bad years and years ago. So yes. I can only imagine. I thought that was getting fixed is the wrong word. Just sort of,
well, this is this is the thing. I think Warcraft has had this problem for a long time. And I think you can say that like there was definitely a creative naivety present in the original Warcraft games in terms of like, I'm going to make a cool orc that's also Yojimbo, and that's cool because I'm doing that because it's cool, and not thinking about the ramifications of just porting a real culture onto a monster of some kind at all. I don't think there was a serious consideration to that. I don't that excuses it at all, but I certainly don't think it was. I think it comes from like I say, naivety, rather than any sort of any malice at all. And then I think they made some real mistakes along the way in terms of coding factions as real cultures in ways that don't have any, like the Tauren, for example.
Are they the buffalo people?
They're the Minotaur people who right. are a sort of mishmash of badly implemented and poorly understood aspects of Native American culture, but who are in like unmistakably intended to be Native American. Like there's no subtlety there. They haven't taken themes and applied it to something that's completely different. They've taken every trope basically and mm-hmm. sort of and smushed it into place. And I think it's actually telling that they've done very little with the Tauren since, because I don't think there's very far you can go with that. Other than changing it. I actually do think that they've gotten better over the years at sort of turning other setting more broadly into this sort of mad cosmopolitan sci-fi fantasy universe where like orcs are basically aliens, everyone's basically aliens, there are light aliens and demon aliens and there's spaceships and mad stuff, and they've sort of moved the lens away from like, look, there's an Eastern Kingdoms which is Europe and there's a Kalimdor which is America and Canadians are night elves, I think, and Native Americans are minotaurs. Like it's just like they've moved away from that somewhat. But they've carried with them these kind of creative decisions they made in the past, one of which is, yeah, the trolls are inexplicably either Caribbean, Jamaican, or like, or sort of again, this mismatch of or mishmash of elements from someone's sort of understanding of what you know, tribal culture or voodoo culture might be like. And it's always been dodgy. But those characters have almost always been on the sidelines, more or less. Not that that's good, but this expansion is an attempt to tell like a more serious story within that setting, basically, to introduce you to this fractious isolationist kingdom where the Horde wants their navy and you have to go in and there's a princess who wants to reunite with the broader world in a bigger way and her kind of, and a king who is sort of noble but conservative and set in his ways in a court of kind of squabbling advisors who can't agree. And the solution that is presented in the first 10 minutes of the expansion is you should open an embassy here and fix all this for us. And I don't think they intended to write, because a lot of the recent expansions have also orbited like you having a base of some kind and building it out. And I don't think they intended to land in to score like the colonialist apologia bullseye, but they whacked it right in the middle. Like they just did it. It just did the thing. They just did the thing where you genuinely are there to kind of educate and reform in order to extract the value you want from this kind of country that can't govern itself. It's horrid, really horrid. And like the thing that that killed it for me, and this is like in addition to that, like the final like killing strike was the fact that all of the characters, the troll characters, like sign off their speech with their kind of like cultural rallying cry, which is, I think it's Zandalar, I'm forgetting that. It's Zandalar forever, as in Wakanda forever, as in they just took the thing from the thing and did the thing. And like, I feel like I was like my parachute pull flashing light kind of like emergency button was like flashing. And then the moment it then did what I think is, I see a lot more of like a more modern Blizzard issue. It happens all the time in Overwatch of just wholesale lifting the source material, like the inspiration rather than adapting it in any way. But that kicked in as well. It was just, oh my God. And actually I was really, really shocked by it because it did like, I found it like viscerally off-putting. And I have had to think about it a lot since, because I've been thinking about my own feelings about it. And like, obviously you have to reiterate the caveats I put at the top of this, because I appreciate it is a heavy subject. Like I don't feel wholly qualified to be, I'm not qualified to be offended on anyone else's behalf. And I would love to, I Googled a lot to try and find if anyone written about this. I didn't notice anyone to bring this up in reviews at all, but I was genuinely, genuinely repelled by it. Mm-hmm. I thought they had done, and maybe I, because of some, you know, I have been thinking a lot about these themes in games recently and how they manifest. I was shocked to see it so nakedly drawn. But yeah, genuinely surprising, particularly because I then went on and like, I was like, I was getting something else out of this and I want to see if I can find it. So I went and made a different character, I made Demon Hunter from an expansion, several expansions ago. And then I had a perfectly entertaining 10 hours of just haring through the world as a mad leaping anime elf man, fighting spaceships and demons and monsters and teleporting from wizard city to wizard city and then to different dimensions, solving, you know, high fantasy nonsense problems. And I was having a good time again. And the coexistence of those two experiences still gives me kind of vertigo, like in terms right. of the depth of that error, I think it's genuine. And I was talking to a friend about it today and I was like, I'm not going mad. And he was like, no, yeah, that first zone's basically Black Panther. The zone after that is Heart of Darkness. And
oh,
I was like,
oh, great.
Oh, oh, Christ.
Oh, man.
And so yeah, so and you know, and then I literally took that character, went back, literally leapt through the portal back to Orgrimmar, ran to the Time Dragon, and was like, "Can you take me to a different expansion? Like, take me to a different one. Can we go to Wrath of the Lich King? Like, I think the worst thing that does is like Swedish walrus men. I think. Like, I'll take it. Take me there, Time Gnome." And off we went, and I'm having a much better time. But like, yeah, damn. I don't think that's how you handle it. I was shocked that it was a thing for 2018. And I think it's also one of the things is they have subsequently, since I stopped playing, like invested big in cutscenes and more voice acting and more writing and more. And I think, I don't know how you solve a problem like someone in the 90s decided Jamaican Trolls was funny, but I don't think you solve it by going, but actually they've got a really deep backstory.
Yeah, I mean, I can see there's a through line from basically an endemic fantasy problem where, you know, other races are always represented by existing cultures on Earth that aren't Western right. cultures, and so you could expect WoW to have inherited that, but I think the timeline here suggests that they really should have wised up to the fact that that wasn't kind of cool.
Yeah,
it is all hardwired in because they you know, obviously there's the Pandaren, you know, who are the kind of Eastern flavored ones who do kung fu, and they're all pandas, like, you know, that doesn't have quite the same repellence to it, but it is all part of this kind of skating over the thin ice of depicting real ethnic groups. Well, with
that, I think
the biggest sort of stereotypes you can find.
Can I speak to that a little bit? Because I think it's a really important distinction. Why that's distinct, and because
I think I know what you're going to say, but
Pandaria. So Pandaria is one of the first press trips I ever did, actually, as a journalist. And so Pandaria's goal, like the reason they made that expansion when they made it, was really twofold, as I understand it. One was that they feared that they needed to bring a younger audience into World of Warcraft in order to sustain it, because it's funny to think about this now, but it was like 2011 and they were worried about the future of the game. And the other was, as part of the same effort, they needed to bring the game to China in a more substantial way. And so that entire expansion was built around, and for many reasons, it's a good idea to have strong Chinese cultural themes if you want to sell a game in China, both in terms of appeal, but also in terms of being approved for sale.
Yeah, but I suspect that they didn't have anybody from China telling you about how successful that was.
No, but like, as far as I understand, it was put together in collaboration with their Chinese partners. I'm not saying it was successful. What I'm saying is there's a really crucial difference of intent. Like, even if whether they're successful or unsuccessful at being sensitive to those cultures, I believe strongly that Pandaria was at least an attempt to bring the game to the Chinese market. I do not believe that Battle for Azeroth was an attempt to bring the game to the Caribbean market, for example.
No, sure. And I wasn't suggesting that. I'm just, I just feel that as an organization, that studio has a tendency or sees unable to do anything imaginative about fantasy, like in imagining fantasy. You know, this is like, I'm going into hard with the boots now, I suppose. I think that it's all rather bankrupt. And I think that, you know, you get stuff like the depiction of Caribbean peoples and African peoples, you know, with the trolls, which is just dreadful. And then you get the Pandaren, which is just pathetic, in my opinion.
Right.
And I appreciate that it might work for the market, but like, fucking come on. If, you know, honestly, if you had somebody working for you that came up with that concept to tap into the Chinese market, you'd probably roll your eyes before, you know, before they then tried to convince you, you know?
Yeah. Like I'm not saying that it's, like I said, what I'm saying is it's relatively sensitive, which is a hell of a thing to say about the fact that they definitely saw Kung Fu Panda at some point.
Yeah, but the like, problem is that like it's relatively sensitive because they see it as a market that kind of,
right,
and they don't see anybody from the Caribbean or Central Africa or whatever as anybody worthy to be sensitive about.
Well, yeah, and I think also specifically like. One thing I believe is that I don't think there's actually like a significant engagement with those cultures as cultures or those peoples as peoples. Yeah. I think there is a significant engagement with those tropes as elements of pop culture. Blizzard loves pastiche. They love to drop in bits of sci-fi, and they have specifically, like, and it comes up again and again, a love of like matinee adventure. And, you know, when they present, you know, tribal civilizations, it's always through that lens. It's the Indiana Jones lens, right? And I think the same was true of their kind of implementation of like Native Americans, for example.
Can you play as a Pandaren?
Yeah, yes. You can.
Can you play as a troll?
Yeah.
Always yes.
Okay, right. Can you play as a troll which has a Caribbean accent, or are they always westernized characters? Okay,
no,
right.
They always have accents, yeah. I like the faction you're visiting is isolationist and doesn't believe you. I think they like don't believe you're like a real troll if you aren't from there. So don't worry, it's okay that you have the same experience as everyone else if you are a troll. Like it's a strange. Like I'm not trying to disagree with you too highly, because I just think it's sort of it's interesting as a point as it pertains to fantasy as a whole and critical world building in fantasy, which is that. Yeah, there aren't any new ideas under the sun, and things, you know, real life elements of culture get mixed and remixed all of the time. But I think you have to be sensitive to the narrative that serves, and historically the narratives that plays into. And I think that's the core of what I perceived as the error here, because it's not to say that I don't roll my eyes at some of this stuff as it shows up in other parts of Warcraft or indeed in other fantasy settings. It's that while it's going to be, if you're writing epic fantasy, it's going to be hard to avoid themes of, you know, oppression and invasion and all of these things that come up again and again, different concepts. And you're always going to be dealing with some fairly weighty themes there. For me, the thing that really killed this was the idea that for one, the kind of out and out kind of like colonizer point of view that it puts you in that felt completely unapologetic, like they didn't realize what the problem was there. And also the dependence, I think, like the kind of almost like umbilical dependence on a different story to give it some shape, coupled with like, I would love to be wrong about this. I want to caveat this by saying, I would love to be wrong about this. Find out that actually it's a lot better than I think it is, because I only played an hour of it. And that, they did some meaningful cultural consultancy on this, sensitivity readings, or ideally had, you know, writers from those cultures inform it. I don't think that happened. I'm putting a guess on that. But I also don't think there was necessarily a recognition of why exactly those processes were so important, for example, to why Black Panther was successful.
Mm.
But yeah, oof, yeah. Basically.
Big oof.
It was a hell of a yikes. And like I say, like, my full on like speak to the manager alarm went off, and when you unsubscribe from WoW, you get a little checkbox, which is like, you know, why are you unsubscribing? And I was like, game content. And then I just like, I only had 500 words and I've already motored through that. No, 500 characters, actually 500 characters, but I tried to make them count.
Did you use the phrase MMO? No.
And, oh shit. Now I've got to subscribe and unsubscribe again. sorry, I want to get into totally into weighty town with all that, but it was a real it's a real surprise to see in the year 2020. Maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe that's my naivety.
Yeah. Well, would you like to hear about another racist game?
Yeah, I guess.
Actually, yeah, I think it's less guilty than that particular depiction. I've been poor listeners tuning into this podcast are thinking that we might even casually approach the zeitgeist. I'm going to be sorely disappointed by this episode, since I've been playing Shadow of the Tomb Raider, which isn't new at all. Yeah, I don't know how. Did you guys play it, for one thing?
No,
I did.
Do you remember how it was received at the time? Because I have no recollection.
I don't remember an awful lot about how it went down, which makes me wonder whether it didn't go down particularly massively.
I remember at the time reading a good very critical review by D.L. Asino about its failings, particularly in terms of its depiction of, again, Indigenous people. But that's all I really remember from the time. Interestingly, I just checked, it did come out within a month of World of Warcraft Battle for Azeroth. So we have achieved the zeitgeist of September 2018.
We've caught up.
Yeah, it does have some interesting problems in that regard, because it sort of veers towards something which is... I wasn't really going to talk about this aspect of it, actually, but I mean, it seems necessary now. Where it opens with Lara Croft, Ms. Tomb Raider herself, picking up basically a cursed dagger and kicking off the Mayan apocalypse. So her theft, her raiding of a tomb itself causes the problems that then she goes on to solve, and she solves those problems by raiding more tombs. So it doesn't really deal with the problematic aspect of raiding tombs in the first place. And it's a real shame, because I think I mentioned on the podcast before that I'm really excited by the idea of a sort of inverse Uncharted, inverse Tomb Raider game, where people steal... People steal artifacts from the British Museum, basically, and repatriate them. And because it's...
You've got like a heist bit at the start, like you've got these levels, which the first half is a heist, like Hitman, and the second half is a tomb delve.
Yes, exactly. Well, no, you wouldn't need to put... I don't know that it needs to be about returning cursed artifacts to the depths of a tomb, but, you know, repatriating them is... Not because that is a completely problem-free process. That itself is highly political and interesting. So, but it has like real-world precedents, which are... Chinese state-sponsored heist teams have been thieving artifacts from museums in Bath, even, amongst other places.
Yeah, there was a break-in in the Oriental Museum, yeah.
Exactly, and taking things that were previously looted from China and taking them back to China. And there's also a very interesting Congolese activist who does similar stunts. He doesn't try to get away with it, though. His intention is to be caught so that it becomes a matter of public interest that he's stealing African artifacts and from their museums in Paris, where they were presumably taken to, having been plundered. Anyway, that's all sort of by the by. But the point is that this Tomb Raider game sort of looks in that direction and then just carries on, making Lara Croft to be, again, the white savior. And she's, you know, welcomed into indigenous villages wherever she goes. And it doesn't matter that she's killed thousands of people in a tsunami. So, yeah, there is that.
And it's kind of, this is good. You're bringing it back to me. So I seem to remember that you know, the main antagonist is actually this also Western organization called
Trinity.
And so I can't remember is how much the game attributes the shit storm that the people, the indigenous people, suffer to the kind of the effects of these two kind of Western groups clashing.
Well, it sort of mealy-mouths it a little bit. Like, Trinity are after the same dagger, but they weren't going to take it from the tomb and cause the Mayan apocalypse until they had a magic box, which they could plug it into or something, and that would give them the power to remake the world without injustice and without pain, essentially remake reality.
Sounds good.
Which, I mean, yes, but the point is, you wouldn't trust these people to decide that for the world. But I don't see that Laura's solution is much better, because just lots of people die. The thing is, the whole thing is at a kind of preposterous register, where it's hard to kind of take it seriously, but the game takes itself so seriously that it really does need to think harder about this stuff. If it was just all kind of lol magic wizards, I mean, I think even Indiana Jones gets away with it better than this,
right?
Because at the end of the day, there is a sort of layer of farce. It doesn't treat itself with the self-seriousness that Tomb Raider does. And I think
Tomb Raider doesn't really kind of hearken to anything. Like, yeah, because Indiana Jones, I think if you put all of its pieces on paper, I think it'd be very, very easy to criticize it. But it has that tone. And also it's hearkening back to, you know, a former...
Yeah,
you know, there's matinee,
like the question with stuff like Indiana Jones, like matinee, like using matinee adventure as a kind of setting now, I think, is how is it, in what ways is it appropriate to play with those particular toys and like those cultural toys and who owns them? And like, you know, at the time when Indiana Jones was being made, no one asked that question, right? You can just make it, you know, you don't have to think about it. Like, if, as long as someone can hear a trombone and see a Nazi, like, yeah. You're probably fine. Like, I think this maybe is the kind of connective tissue here is that an attempt to kind of maturity is not depth, and nor is it sensitivity, right? Like, maturity of subject matter or kind of depth of suffering experienced by main character, particularly in the case of those Tomb Raider games, does not kind of equate to like a more sensitive use of the genre. In any way, really, as far as I can tell.
But I don't even think that it's trying to think about that genre at all. I think Martin was right. I think it is too self-serious for that. And I think that the new Tomb Raider games are so wrapped up in the character of Lara Croft. They are just entirely, you know, their solution to what you do with a series which kind of burst out of a early PlayStation game with a female character who was kind of given reason to exist because she had big tits. You know, that was where that series came from, and their way of washing their hands of that and kind of making the IP good for them was to delve into the character, you know, make her super realistic, you know, remake her, do an origin story, look into the dark past, and then play lip service to, is it good to raid the tombs? But yes, because you're going to be doing it during the game anyway. I think that's the weird tension with that whole series is the fact that they've had to double down on a character which has no business other than doing something which is kind of a bit problematic and kind of out of time.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I wanted to talk about was actually how it handles or mishandles, well, the entire enterprise of writing, really, specifically with regards to how it handles Lara and shaping her as a character, because it's every single narrative beat, it takes the opportunity to be discursive, directly discursive of that character and her backstory and her relationship with her sidekick. And it's exhausting and absurd from the off, because, you know, you've just murdered a couple of Jaguar and you've rocked up to this sort of absurdly elaborate Incan water-powered drawbridge puzzle, and your sidekick is just somberly telling you about his childhood poverty. you're like, come on, man, that's not the time. You know, and it treats like every conversation as this therapy session where the characters need to unburden themselves of their deepest feelings and traumas. And like, that's, you know, you should convey character by having the characters act characterfully. You don't need to have the characters describe themselves to you. Anyway, so that's really maddening. And it's I didn't particularly love the writing in any episode of this series, but I do believe that this the third installment since it got rebooted, this one is made by Eidos Montreal rather than Crystal Dynamics, and I don't think it has the same team of writers. So maybe that is one of the reasons these problems have been exacerbated. I don't really know. There's a lot of other weird things about the game which makes it feel like the work of a different studio who didn't quite know what to do with it, or possibly tried to take it in a different direction and then were reined in or reined themselves in. Or it's very much a game of odd parts and strange compromises.
What drew you to it?
I don't know. For ages I've been coveting it. I don't know quite why. I think it's because I really want another Uncharted game, which is just a fairly uncomplicated, cheerful matinee adventure where you do the jumping and then you do a bit of shooting and then you do some puzzles. You know, it's just a satisfying. In fact, it goes back to what you were saying before about being, just a wanton pillow man, desperate for comfort. It's just comfort food, really. And I've been kind of jonesing for that. And I did like the last two games to a point. Like, I think they are, in every way that they try and be Uncharted, they are full sort of almost laughably short, which is sort of ironic because obviously Uncharted was the sort of very consciously indebted to Tomb Raider when it was launched, and now Tomb Raider looks with misty eyes towards Uncharted's encapsulation of cinema and just can't cultivate it itself. But in terms of the way that that series has taken that cutscene to cutscene assault course, it has been quite interesting because you can see this sort of tension in the Tomb Raider games as it tries to pull away from being just that linear cinematic corridor. And periodically in the previous two games, the sort of linear talky stuff would disappear and you'd be thrown into these large hub spaces where Lara was free to cavort around and scamper and zip line and rappel and whilst, you know, murdering waves of paramilitaries and so forth. And those were really successful. They didn't really fit within the structure of the game otherwise, but individually they were quite satisfying little arenas, I thought. And this game is trying to do something even more divergent from that cinematic paradigm, where it's maybe you can even see the sort of DNA of Deus Ex, which is the series that Eidos Montreal was working on prior to this, where there's these sort of non-combat areas in towns and you do sort of linear talky stuff and you can go and chat to people and sort out their small problems. But it doesn't never really sits cozily with the main plot, because, you know, you should probably deal with the Mayan apocalypse that you've started rather than finding people's cats or whatever. And it just never really fits cozily with the level design either, which is doesn't know what it is. So it has these hubs and then there's these generally quite linear paths between them. But even those linear paths are made to feel incredibly organic. The level design, the aesthetics of the game are fantastic, but they're so organic that you just can't see where the prescribed path is. And then even though the levels are quite linear, there's just this overabundance of crafting materials that hints at a survival game, which never really emerges. And it's just this really odd mix. I don't know quite how they achieved the compromise that they ended up at, but it's not very good.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think I think what's funny about returning to the comfort theme, which is maybe like this is, I mean, that's, if it's nothing else, the theme of this episode, which is very comfortable men discussing comfortable things. is that like, and I found the Uncharted series, that those are very comfortable games, right? Their tone is very breezy, but also, like, you know, and I think, you know, there's almost certainly much to kind of critique in their kind of embrace of the matinee adventure thing, but they're doing it all kind of with a bit of a smile, and there's some drama and stuff, but it's very much like, it's not like Indiana Jones slapstick necessarily. I would describe it as like, I don't know, Marvel movie smirking to some extent. Yeah. But there's a sort of bounce. There's definitely a bit of a bounce in its step as it moves along. And that is tonally consistent with the feel of playing those games, which is kind of being told that you're in danger, but always really knowing what to do next. You know, the very elegant Naughty Dog kind of signposting and kind of clear and clarity. Knowing that you're along for the ride. And that's not a pejorative, like that's part of its comfort factor. Like the same thing that would have like a From Software, you know, purists kind of turn their nose up at it is exactly the reason it's successful, because there is a match of theme and feeling and mechanics and design, an assonance, if you will, in that. And what's interesting is the dual mission that those Tomb Raider games seem to have been going on, which is both to take what is so successful about the Uncharted games and their own relationship with Tomb Raider, which is pointedly the Uncharted games took the fantasy of playing Tomb Raider and made that real, as opposed to the reality of playing Tomb Raider, which was getting stuck, pushing blocks around, falling down things, getting chased by dinosaurs and dying, which was really fun. But like, I mean, maybe there's something in this which is kind of interesting, which is that like, I think old Tomb Raider's game about navigating a big, mad 3D environment maze and it being tough and punishing and, you know, sometimes very inconsistently checkpointed and needing to kind of pick apart these levels in order to understand them, does have shades of a From Software game to it in a way. Mm. There's a game to be made there about, on you know, cracking open an environment and mastering it. Uncharted identified that as a problem and solved it by putting you on comfortable, putting your little sofa on casters and wheeling you down a hill to adventure. and what is really interesting is the, you know, subsequent Tomb Raider games identified that as part of, you know, that's a desirable thing, that ease and that accessibility. But on the flip side, they had this idea, this desire, as Alex has pointed out, to kind of add depth to that character by making sure that nothing good ever happens to her, and she never enjoys anything. and so that, and I think that has always been the core kind of tonal disconnect of those games, is that like, even as you say, the gesture towards like crafting and survival and stuff, and like, but it's a gesture that's out of sync with one of the game's core aims, which is to be a bit like Uncharted. But also I don't think you can take Uncharted style ease and marry it to a game about suffering. Like, I will confess here that I think I've gone on this rant on the podcast before, and also the only one of these games I've played is the first one, and I really didn't like it. And the reason I really didn't like it is I thought it was mean-spirited, really. And I thought that I didn't feel like I got a meaningful story about suffering out of it because it was married to the opposite game.
Yeah.
And I think that for me was a fairly big issue. But it's interesting that like they still, even though each of these games is different from what I hear, they keep navigating the same place, but that rift seems to still exist in the middle of it.
Yeah, you've nailed it there. I don't see how they're going to marry those two threads if they continue with this particular reboot era of Tomb Raider. I don't think they can switch gears and turn it into the matinee adventure from this point.
I mean, not on the same arc, no. But like the IP can do it, you know. It's like,
yeah.
You're saying they can't do like Lara Kart in this arc. it's a kart racer, but she's having a horrible time. She did not. This is not the birthday party she had in mind. She wanted to go paintballing.
That would have ended in disaster as well. Lara Croft blinded. Oh dear. Bring back Chris Barry. That's what the series needs. Chris Barry is the comedy butler. Right? You're with me on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeez.
In what did he play a comedy butler in?
The Lara Croft films with Angelina Jolie.
Did he?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
The height of his Hollywood career, I think, unfortunately. I tell you what, though.
Oh, man.
If you shoot an arrow at a man with a helmet, it makes a really fantastic plonk noise. Pay rise to that Foley artist.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the truest things about game development, I think, is like audio engineers are always, always, always like earning their keep. Like,
the rest of the game's problematic as crap, but here I go.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, nice. I mean, I think it's a good general theory. Is like, how much of games that we feel compelled to defend, even though they've obviously got problems, is just it's like some really good bonk noises in them.
Yeah,
the tombs I do remember the tombs being good and worth raiding. They were good at being big and good at you know, providing spectacle.
Do you think so? Because I mean, I haven't completed the game yet, but I think actually the puzzles themselves are also a weak point so far in that I
agree with that.
I don't, you know, the good thing, I mean, obviously all the Tomb Raider and Uncharted puzzles of lore are always nonsense of a certain kind. You know, you have to rotate a bunch of skulls so that a giant bell descends so you can dong the bell, and then a mirror on the side of the bell rocks into a beam of light which reflects to over here to ignite a torch or something. But an important aspect of those puzzles is that as stupid as that mechanism is, it is a mechanism. Like, there isn't just, it's not just a sequence of arbitrary button pushes. There is a mechanical causality to it. So you can figure it out. Like, oh, if I pull this lever here, this hammer activates. So I need to maneuver this bell over here so it will hit it. But the puzzle design in this game doesn't, it feels way more fragmentary than that. It's like they've got the nonsense part down, but they haven't designed a mechanism for it. So you're just like, this plate with some symbols has appeared on it. I guess I just input those over here. Yep. Okay. Another plate's arrived and it's got some different symbols on it. I guess I put those in. Yep. And it's just like there's no systemic relationship between the actions you take. As far as I can tell, like maybe the puzzles do get more complicated later. And I remember
getting really badly stuck on some. I remember a lot of them being totally nothing to me. It was just something in my way for a brief time. Yeah. But yeah, the puzzles weren't good, but the spectacle I remember being good.
Good plonk noises, as we've established.
Good plonk noises.
You know that Foley artists do real work in comparison to other people at a game studio, because they're the only people who emerge from a sealed room covered in like melon juice at the end of the day from having smashed a billion melons to make the correct sound of a person's head exploding.
Is that for you a consistent measure of how hard you think someone's working? Like, how sticky have they become?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we've all become sticky at work, but that's from, you know, accidental explosions of juice boxes and things like that. It's not from you know, intentional. If you've made yourself sticky intentionally, then you've done a day's work.
Wow, I have lived a life of indolence. In the dawning realization. I'm glad we've managed to put September 2018 to bed. If nothing else.
Yeah.
Oh God, what have we got to go? What came out in October 2018? That's what we're doing next week.
Let's find out. How about a bit of Red Dead Redemption 2?
I've really got to finish that, so yeah, let's do that.
Oh man. Bit of Assassin's Creed Odyssey, bit of Forza Horizon 4, bit of Call of Duty Black Ops 4, bit of Soul Calibur 6. I mean, you get Tom Senior on, that's not out of the question. Bit of Spider-Man 2018, bit of Destiny 2 Forsaken, bit of Sea of Thieves, which I have been playing recently. Yeah, we could do this.
A lot of these games are very current, because Odyssey and Red Dead Redemption 2 are on my haven't done with these games.
That's interesting. Still there. Is it not the case that maybe, I mean, I appreciate that recent history suggests that we can live in 2018 for as long as you want, but is it not maybe the case that it's time to move on? It's also mad to me that was 2 years ago. That doesn't feel like 2 years ago.
No.
It feels either more or less, but not two.
Should we do some of those questions from questions?
Oh, go on then.
Okay. I have three questions. Three questions. The first question comes from TJ House. TJ writes, "Hello. I played World of Warcraft for many years. To me, its most impressive aspect was the believability of the world as a place in a system. Your character was a small part of a big world. Contributing a few stacks of cotton to a world event that required 2 million stacks really cemented this point. You were what did you make of yourself? The world doesn't care, regard you as special. Then the latest expansions introduce phased world areas, and a new character was now on a first name basis with Malfurion fucking Stormrage after a solid day of boar murder. This kind of thing to me diluted the simulatory aspects of the world in the game as a whole. Now Destiny 2 is taking one tiny step back from its original 'you are the sole protagonist of reality' position, and Chris Bristles, I think that's Chris Bristling last week, if you want to catch up with that. Not everyone, says TJ House, can or should be the number one space-lader bullshit person. And his question is the following. What's your favorite game world that doesn't give a shit about you or your agency? And how did it sell that feeling? Mine was Neo Scavenger when I died because my plastic bag tore open. Cheers, TJ House.
All right. Well, so here's the thing. Like, I don't think you can ascribe one set of goals to any game. And I don't think, while I also share in some context the desire to be fully immersed in a game that allows me to carve up my own corner without necessarily being the focal character, I think there's also tremendous value to doing the opposite and having the player be the main character in some way, depending on the effect you're trying to achieve. Almost like it's a big old spectrum of experiences that games can furnish. I think the thing that I bristle at is inconsistency, particularly when that inconsistency isn't even encompassed within a kind of gradual change over time. Warcraft's case is interesting because it always had both. Like, while yes, there were the moments where you were a small cog in a big machine, it also is the thing that introduced quests to the MMO, quests in the way that it did, quests as singular stories that you were asked to kind of buy the suspension of disbelief that everybody was the one person who did it. And in doing so, it began life with this through line of your singular narrative and your singular importance, maybe not to the whole world, but to specific people in specific places, as a way to draw you through by reassuring you again and again that actually you were doing things that were meaningful in some way, rather than, as you might have done in EverQuest previously, just sat on a hillside killing goblins for 15 hours in order to level up. Which is true, feeling like a small cog in a big machine. Also, famously, it was keen to roll out feelings of specialness to specific players, like the people who got to open the gates of Ankh-Morpork, while also having that moment where, like, yeah, a ton of players were the ones to finally kill Ragnaros or Onyxia or whatever. So it always did both. And then recently, they obviously over time trended towards this very different feeling where, yeah, now if you jump into one of the very narrative-driven classes or campaigns or expansions, then yeah, you're best friends with 15 different key characters within 20 minutes of starting. I can understand having a preference between those two things. I don't think one of them is more valid than the other. And I think in WoW's case, you can specifically point to a change in style and a change in attitude over a long time, which means that you can say, well, it might not be consistent with where the game started, but it is consistent with the strategy and the desires of its creators. And you don't have to like it, but I don't think it feels out of sync with what is being attempted. In Destiny's case, the reason I bristle at it is because to this day, your character, your Guardian remains the main character of Destiny consistently. And so it is, for me, tonally disjointed when they suddenly kind of break with that for a different purpose. And I don't think you achieve that kind of simulatory depth by having one element of fairly arbitrary feeling for the moment. Like that doesn't make a simulation, that just makes a moment of frustration. And so I kind of understand the spirit of the question, but nay, I say, I don't think it's the same thing. And I think, however, I will say that I do understand the appeal in its own way of being a small cog in a big machine. And I think the two games I would draw attention to as having achieved this, one is Elite Dangerous. Which is very good at making you realize space big. And that's all it needs to do, really. Like, you know, it provides you with things to do. And I think someone put it out on Discord recently, apologies for not remembering the username off the top of my head, that like it does a good job of letting you know what's going on in the wider universe just through the in-game news and stuff to let you be whatever sized cog you want to be and have a sense that there's something going on, but also kind of live a life that's very much your own. Which is, and the other game I put in this bracket as an interesting example of this is Star Wars Galaxies, which also very much achieved letting you just live a life and get by however you could in that universe, and then went through its own horrible, wrenching shift in away from that simulationist fantasy into like iconic character classes and kind of iconic Star Wars experiences, and lost its soul in doing so. And that's the bad example in my mind of like, a sudden change of attitude to the player and the effect that it has. But really, like, what I object to is the change in attitude. Had Star Wars Galaxies launched as a game about iconic Star Wars characters, blah, 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 like the Old Republic did, it wouldn't be nearly as much of a problem, because the idea itself is not bad. It's selling one thing and then changing gears quite spectacularly. I do also respect that there's probably WoW players who feel that happened to their own game as well. All right, sorry. Rant desk closed. Anyone else?
I definitely feel like, say, the Spire doesn't care about me or my agency. But that's just because I'm bad. But I kind of, I'm sort of having a little look through my recent Steam games, and it looks like I go for the hero games too much.
What an egotist.
It's like I want to be the center.
Yeah. There are games, I mean, there's obviously multiplayer games where you are, by definition, not the center, like EVE Online, you know? I mean...
Mm. I was going to say, there's the whole span of, like, Rust and its ilk, right? Of, you know, survival game, multiplayer survival things where, like, I don't know, like, you can be kidnapped by bigger kids and they can steal your things and piss on you.
Yeah, sure. DayZ or whatever.
Yeah.
I tell you what, an interesting trick is to find games which... give you that sensation, but do actually nonetheless satisfy the egotism of you know, making your single player experience meaningful within the context of the wider world. I think like something like Stalker does a good. I mean, maybe it feels quite quaint now, given the sophistication of NPC AI that you see in any kind of open world game. But at the time, it was quite novel to be in a first person shooter where there was just other factions wandering around this landscape, having battles, doing their own thing, seeking their own, you know, agenda. And it was quite terrifying because it did feel, just the fact that you weren't immediately centered within that world made you feel very vulnerable suddenly, yeah. In a way which you weren't in other more kind of clear empowerment fantasy first-person shooters. And I think that's the real interesting trick, is when a game can, you know, can still service you as obviously the central actor within a fiction and a game, and yet at the same time make you feel like you're a part of a larger world. That's an interesting trick to pull off.
Tell me I'm bad and special.
Yes.
I've got we've got another question here from CBs, who writes, so I had a thought during last pod's discussion of Phantom Brigade, particularly the rumination on things they should fix in early access. The other day I watched a stream of someone trying Teardown for the first time, and it was pretty much a disaster. They were clearly having a bad week, day, month, or 2020, and wanted to unwind with a knockabout demolition simulator, working out some frustrations on some helpless voxels. This was possibly worse because the game seemed to tease the fantasy with the first tutorial mission, and then snatches it away in favor of the speedrunning that it's actually about. As if they were denied what they thought the game was, the streamer became increasingly frustrated and petulant, just savaging the game in front of an audience of hundreds. Choice phrases like the devs clearly don't know what the good part of their own game is, and I hope enough people hammer on them while it's in early access that they fix this. This being the fact that the game is about cover feet speedrunning. To put it in the form of a question instead of a ramble, how much should games in early access have to explain to the player what they actually are? Should the early access games include some statements of developer intent? Delineate some areas that aren't up for a debate in the final product. And at the risk of being a cheerleading squad, if you see someone being wrong on the internet and putting out an awful first impression of a game to a bunch of people, should you speak up and probably get banned from the stream from it? CBs did not. Cheers and cheer for podding, CBs. This is an interesting one, actually, because... I, Alex, just spoke to Dennis, who's the lead developer on Teardown, in part about the reception of the game in terms of the fact that it's this apparently freewheeling, open physics-based destruction game. And as soon as you make a physics game, I think it starts to make some promises about you being able to do what you want in that world. I think also making it out of voxels kind of starts to reinforce that idea. You get this idea of Minecraft and kind of open-ended sort of environments where you can do whatever the hell you want. And of course, what I want to write about is the fact that, you know, he found it really hard to find the game within this physics world, which is, it was actually started out as a rendering. What's the cool rendering thing that the new graphics electrics to
ray tracing
experiment. Yeah. Ray tracing experiment. And then that kind of folded into a physics thing as well. So he found it really hard to find the game within that. And then the game that he found in that is at odds with, I think, a lot of people's assumptions. I mean, my son came in and watched me play Teardown and he loved it from the moment he looked at it, but he wants to build stuff in it. He likes planks and he just builds teetering piles of planks. And, you know, like it definitely isn't a building game. But like, I think that the game is particularly open to people coming in and assuming that it's not what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. He couldn't have done much more with his Steam store page and the videos he put out to more clearly explain what the game is.
Right.
I mean, the Steam description is pretty clear. Prepare the perfect heist, tear down walls to create shortcuts, etc. I mean, it's sort of there, and the video is pretty explicit. I also think that the game that this streamer wants is in there. You can play each of the levels as pure sandboxes where you have unlimited ability to destroy things.
Yeah.
So you can do it. You can also have unlimited planks if you want. So Jack can go and build whatever he wishes. I think it's a really interesting question that's raised here about how you manage expectations with early access. I don't think that Teardown is especially guilty of it, though. Although it is interesting. I hadn't considered the assumptions that one might make looking at it from the perspective of it being a voxel game. That what you say there actually strikes me as being incredibly true, that people cursorily might look at it and make assumptions. But to be honest, if you're a streamer and you're frustrated that the game isn't what you thought it was, but you didn't spend 40 seconds watching the trailer in advance, then it's sort of your own fault.
Can I be a lamentable plank centrist here?
Take the middle.
Like the so here's the, like, I think there's a good point here, and it's interesting to hear the question about, like, I think there's a bunch of interesting things about this. One is, I think the notion of finding the game and finding this game as the game is a really interesting one, and I think you found a really good game. However, I think the criteria by which that were judged were actually quite specific, and I think the one, like, potential takeaway from this negative reaction is potentially that maybe the game could do a little bit more to foreground the fact that it does have these sort of sandbox or kind of knockabout modes, to sort of recognize that actually there's a desire for that and push it forward. That like physics toy side of it is really valuable to specific audiences. And I would argue that there's maybe a point here about, I think Teardown's really interesting because it has, in addition to having the look and the feel of voxel game, it also has the look and feel of a very Twitch or YouTube friendly game. With its replay feature and everything else, and also just with the slapstick kind of physics nature of it. But I don't think it actually is. And I think I think it can be, but I'll caveat that. I think what's interesting about it is, in service of making a robust game out of its physics, you know, technical experiment sort of origins, particularly given the kind of game that it's made and what the value that's been brought to bear in doing so, is like, how do you establish a skill ceiling in this? How do you establish skillful play? How do you create interesting decisions? Solving that problem has meant, I think, maybe probably unintentionally, putting loads of blocks and blockers in the way of, like, the traditional things that kind of make things good, Twitch fare, which are like sudden surprising outcomes, accidents that kind of emerge dramatically from play, right? Like, this is a very honorable use of the same tech that would otherwise power something like Goat Simulator, but it's almost lost that sort of spontaneity, because I think the thing about it is it's about spending ages meticulously preparing something, rapidly undoing mistakes in order to set up a perfect run where nothing goes wrong, which is really compelling as a game and real bad for Twitch a lot of the time, unless you're watching a player who's, like, spectacularly good at it, or, like, for example, watching one of Tom Francis's videos of watching someone's process. Like, it's a very different experience. And so I do think there's maybe a degree here to which, like, they maybe neglected the needs of streamers a little bit and what their impressions would be. I don't think that excuses those streamers from not actually looking at the description of the game at all. Totally. I think it's an interesting dynamic.
And I think that Dennis, I think his interest in game design comes from a puzzle background. If you look at the games that he's made before, in particular, his stuff on mobile, he made a physics-based puzzle game that was really popular called Smash something, like, you know, hundreds of millions of downloads, you know, really, really successful with that. He also made, did you come across the game Does Not Commute? It's really cool. So top-down view driving game, and you see a little grid of a city, and you get you basically start time over and over again with a car. So you start with a car, bottom left corner, for instance, and you've got to drive to a point on a road, top right corner. You've got to drive across the city in order to get there, and then time rewinds, and you start with another car, and you've got to drive to a different point, and you know, five cars into it, you're avoiding your at the cars that you've previously drove in order to find the point that your new car has to go to. It's just a cool,
that's cool.
It's really nice little neat game. I think that, and you know, when I spoke to Dennis, he was, you know, he made a very critical discovery during the process of designing the game, which was the game was most fun when it allowed you to freedom to do destruction, to do the optimization, to do the breaking of the world, and then to choose the point at which you set off the alarm, and then the countdown begins and the heist starts. And but the point that I found really interesting was that for him, the game always had to be one. It was a puzzle game. It's a game about optimization of route. It's about solving problems. It's not. Yeah, it's exactly what you. Not what you said, you know, it's not the Twitch friendly or necessarily friendly knockabout game, rambunctious sort of fun zone thing, which is, you know, I think that I, you know, whether someone else can find another game within Teardown's world, I'd love to see that. I'd love him to open a kind of like game jam or something. Here's the tools and make your game with this stuff, and to see these other flavors of stuff.
I mean, arguably Teardown does that itself, because it's, I mean, although it returns to this timed heist thing, where you do build a spilt speedrun past, there's a bunch of other levels within it which differ from that in quite dramatic ways. And I suspect as it reaches the end of its early access period, it will add to the variety of the kinds of things it does within its world. They're all going to be, I suspect, reasonably well directed. Like, there will always be an objective which you need to optimize for in some way. But even within that, I think there probably will be more pure destruction levels, because that's something that the game dallies with itself. I think, though, if it was purely about dismantling things, it would get very boring very quickly. Yeah. That just doesn't seem to hold the same variety.
Well, you're dead right.
It's weird that this criticism is being leveled at Teardown, because I think not only is it one of my favorite games of the year,
right,
if not my favorite game of the year, but putting that bias aside, it's incredibly varied. Like, there's so much going on in it, and the things that the streamer objects to do are like important parts of the game. You know, it's not like you don't scratch the destruction itch while playing it. That's definitely part of it, and you can destroy quite a lot. And even outside of the sandbox levels, just in the course of the main campaign, you do a heck of a lot of smashing shit. So I don't know. It seems like maybe the guy was just having a bad day, and you can't really solve for that, I think.
I think maybe, and I think maybe to answer that part of the question, like, I think even if this stream was watched by hundreds of viewers, and even if it's obviously unfortunate if someone misunderstands or doesn't enjoy the game in this way, like, it's really not the end of the world for a project. Like, I think a lot about what can generate that kind of, like, I think, mimetic kind of bad feel, like, where those kind of narratives start to spread. And that's where you're in trouble. Like, if the narrative gets out into Twitter or YouTube or whatever that, like, Teardown's a con for whatever reason, if that gains momentum, then the developers have a problem. In this case, what they have is an isolated bit of negative feedback that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny, like, as an independent scrutiny, and therefore will probably not catch on. And the because there isn't really like a robust truth to it necessarily. The other side of it is, you can just, you know, look at it and go, okay, is there a reasonable point here? The point I was trying to make earlier is that, like, yeah, maybe there is something to learn from it, which is that, well, maybe there is a slight disconnect between, maybe the store page is fine, but there's a slight disconnect between the game's opening moments and what it becomes. And,
yeah, sure.
You know, like, there's, you know, there's something that could be done to smooth that, or maybe foregrounding the optional ways to play would be an idea. Nothing major, just, you know, tweaks to be made. And then the other alternative is to go, this is criticism, but this is not criticism along lines that we're interested in pursuing. So we don't need to feel bad about it. This person is angry that, you know, this person is angry that they can't leave the stadium in FIFA and drive off in a car. And that's like, yeah. You shouldn't lose sleep over that if you're a FIFA developer, right?
I'll also point out that the first image on the teardowns carousel on the Steam page has the alt text, no. It tickles me. Good alt text.
I think that must be because like Steam's screenshot upload feature has like enter alt text.
So
they just replied. He looked up and whispered, enter alt text, and he looked down and whispered, no. Which is a shame because it's useful for accessibility, but never mind, that's me being
our final question for this evening comes from Tom Lando, who writes, Cratatabulous Crowbers, if you're an end of level boss, which unlikely weak points do you have that would glow or flash for the benefit of the player? I've just noticed, is the title, which would be, mine would be my nose.
I mean, if I'm not going to be just one large glowing weak spot, which I suspect is the case, then currently it would be my left knee, which I've done a mischief to by basically being an inert fucking blob for 12 months and then having the temerity to try and stand up too quickly. Now it hurts.
Our bodies were not designed for such things.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting distinction here between like what physical part of your body is the weakest and design a boss encounter with you in it. I'm not sure like what my physical Achilles heel necessarily is.
Mine's my esophagus. Mine would kind of this unholy vertical glow through my body, pulsing angrily for hours on end. That would be
you look like you'd be a spitter, Alex. that'd be your main attack.
He rears back. Rears back and like flares his
acid reflex. Yeah. Acid reflux, wrong.
I have eaten and now you will suffer too.
I think for me, it's like I would be like in a big arena full of shit I inexplicably love. And like at some point before the damage phase, I would like randomly pick a pointless object in the room that I am inexplicably attached to. And I would begin to like actively like focus on it. And if you were to mar that object or criticize it in that time, I'd just become quite sad and then become vulnerable to the subsequent DPS phase. Like I just sort of plonk back down on my bum and it's like, well, now I'm not talking about it.
So you're like a puzzle boss. So you could go walk
in. Yeah, I'm thinking myself more like a
what is item here, in there's an item in here that if you just mar just that one item, you would just collapse.
Criticize Warhammer now. And then it's like, I'm like, well, fuck you then. And then I sit down and then you can DPS my face or something. I'm trying to think physically. I think for me, it would be some kind of allergy. Like, I think the other version of this would be like, bait me into eating Ben and Jerry's fish food, which almost is a very reliable migraine trigger for me. And then I'll take substantial psychic damage. I don't know. I love designing this encounter. This is a great exercise. That's quite therapeutic.
So you walk into Chris's boss room, you find the Ben and Jerry's fish food, throw it in your face, and then you look towards the object that you venerate?
Well, I think that's combining. I think the object, venerated object, is if I was a Destiny raid boss. The fish food is if I was a regular boss battle, where that'd be like an RPG encounter where that's the thing you can bring in from a different part of the game to make the encounter easier. I think if I was a Dark Souls boss, I would just have like one attack where I massively overcommit to something, and like at that point you can hit me, like you could just hit me right in the belly, like just go to town. But just tell me I'm special. That's all. That's fine.
I feel like I need to mention this point that the alt text has remained on my screen no matter what I do. So I have the word no in a little white box in the center of my screen, seemingly permanently now, which is a suitable repudiation of me and my life.
Well, we were talking about how to defeat us. Marsh was defeated.
By alt text.
Yeah. Were those all the questions, Alex?
Those are the three, yeah.
Wow. If you'd like to send us another question, you can send them to questions@CreightonCrowbar.com or you can tweet us at Creighton Crowbar. You can check out these recordings as videos on YouTube. And there's other videos by us there as well. Address for that is youtube.com/CreightonCrowbar. Thanks as always to our Patreon backers. You can back us too at patreon.com/CreightonCrowbar, or you can simply join us on our lovely Discord community to lambast Chris and his bad Destiny opinions forever and ever and ever. The link for that is on our website, CreightonCrowbar.com. That's it. I've been a big useless pillow man who only wants comfort.
I've been a long-suffering ill man.
And I've been Morgo the Globulark. Behold my rotundity.
Thanks. You sound like somebody who would actually like to be covered in Alex's reflux attack.
This is good, actually. I like it. I have no weakness, he said, rolling away. It's good to end this episode on a positive note.
Don't believe me. Everybody. Tonix likes the gold takes.
Behold, Morgo's final form. Take me to the lamp.